This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 39th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have Matt Blaze here with me today. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Matt Blaze is an associate professor of computer and information science at the University of Pennsylvania. Matt's research focuses on architecture and design of secure systems based on cryptographic techniques, analysis of secure systems against practical attack models, and advancing cryptography. Matt is especially interested in using encryption to protect insecure systems such as the internet. Matt has been particularly active in public policy aspects of computer security and has testified before the U.S. Congress and European Parliament several times. Matt holds a PhD in computer science from Princeton and apparently also coined the term trust management. So the first question really is not one that I usually ask Silver Bullet at this point, but here you go. It's more amusing to do it now, I suppose. You do realize that we're recording this conversation without a warrant of any kind.
I just assume that's the case.
And you're okay with that, right?
I'm okay with that.
Usually we ask ahead of time.
I'm at peace with that.
Most excellent. You're being surveilled. So much of your work has focused on the interaction between security technology and public policy. And what is your view on the Obama administration's cyber coordinator idea in the current speech?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because, of course, we don't know any of the details, and the devil's always in the details. But I think the big concern initially is that, you know, there's a question of what role the intelligence community, in particular the NSA, is going to play in this. And, you know, to the extent that the NSA contributes, what we have to worry about is how the needs of the intelligence community that they really understand very well don't match the needs of the civilian and other government community, which demonstrably they don't understand nearly as well.
Right. So to some extent, I suppose another way of putting that would be they would be working at cross purposes. It's easier to do spying and spycraft if you have exploitable conditions you know about.
Well, that's certainly part of it. But I think that's not the whole story. It's easy to paint a picture of the NSA as being, you know, this big, you know, evil dark side organization that's interested in spying and things that we don't want turned on us. But, you know, that's certainly part of their mission is to spy on American adversaries, and we certainly have to be concerned about that capability being turned on U.S. citizens, you know, and there's certainly risks there. But It would be a mistake to kind of caricature the debate or the potential problems as stopping with that. You know, there's also a bit of a cultural mismatch between the computer security point of view of a military organization, which is very hierarchical, top down, has a central locus of control, all authority kind of starts with the President of the United States and works down, and that you can kind of tell whether something is allowed or not allowed in a fairly straightforward way, relatively straightforward way. Whereas in the rest of the world, pretty much anything outside the military, including the rest of the government, is much messier than that. And an organization like the NSA, has extraordinarily deep expertise in serving the InfoSec needs of this well-understood military community, but has at best a mixed record in dealing with the needs of the rest of us.
Right. So you're talking about culture more than that.
So I'd be concerned both with the cross purposes question. You know, they have a bit of a conflict of interest. They have to maintain an ability to spy, and they have to also protect us from spying. Mm-hmm. It may not be possible to serve both of those masters mm-hmm. simultaneously, but I'd also be concerned with the cultural mismatch.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. In terms of the new coordinator position, what kind of person do you suppose would be best for that role?
Well, I think the first question that we'd have to ask is, what is that role?
I don't think anybody knows.
Right. And I think, until we answer the question, well, what's the appropriate role of the government? What should that role be? Should this role even exist? Talking about the best person to do it is really putting the cart before the horse.
Well, by all means, let's get the horse first. So, should the government be doing this?
Well, again,
how did you phrase that exactly? Answer your own damn question, would you?
Well, I'm an academic. I don't have to answer my question.
You're like Rumsfeld.
The thing that we have to realize is that the government definitely not just has a right, but has a responsibility to protect its information system. So there's, no doubt that the government has a proper role in doing that. Mm-hmm. Now, the first question you have to ask now is, does centralizing that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it makes sense to the extent that the government is one thing, but I'm not sure the government is one big thing. The government is this very complicated thing with weird interconnections to other governments and to citizens and to the states and the local authorities. So, is there anyone who even is in charge of the government's information systems? They use a lot of civilian networks. They are using the same software that the rest of us are using. So, the first question we have to ask is, well, what's the scope of this? And mm-hmm. I'm not even sure anybody has actually asked that question in a meaningful way yet.
I think
let alone
people
come
have.
Up with an answer.
I think people have tried, or they've been at least assigned that job, but all of the homework assignments seem to have come back as cyber platitudes of some sort or another.
Right, and it's very easy to say meaningless things about this.
Mm-hmm.
But once we talk about the real details of this, then it becomes a lot harder.
Well, that's always a challenge for anyone in technology when it comes to even explaining what the heck it is that we're working on.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it gets thornier when you throw in security and intention and spying and surveillance and good guys and bad guys and millions of dollars flowing around electronically.
That's true.
So one of the things, I guess a big challenge in a democracy is trying to get legislative bodies to understand what the hell we're talking about as well as the representatives of the rest of the population. And
that's
I know,
right. And to the extent that we ourselves don't understand it, trying to explain that to our elected officials is really a kind of a lost cause, right?
Especially some of them.
Well, and it's not just because, they're not as tech savvy as us. It's easy for us to say, oh, well, the problem is Congress, these Congress people, they're just stupid. But the truth is, we don't know what we want.
That's true. So you've testified before Congress or the Parliament how many times?
A bunch. Probably too much.
More than four?
On advice of counsel, I don't recall.
Any good stories from those episodes or any particular successes?
Well, the definition of success when it comes to policy is, keeps becoming smaller and smaller and smaller. I remember, when I started doing computer security, and computer security became a matter of public policy, kind of much to my surprise when I started working in the area,
mm-hmm.
When we discovered that crypto policy in the U.S., just barely raised the question as to whether cryptography was even legal.
Right.
There were these crazy export laws. They were trying to do key escrow. The FBI director and the NSA were saying that, uncontrolled crypto was a huge threat to our national security.
Was
and they were doing everything
as a
they could to discourage civilian crypto from proliferating. When, of course, you know, pretty much everybody in computing systems, you know, not just cryptographers, but pretty much everybody who understood the first thing about the internet and network computing and operating systems and so on, you know, understood that there was simply no hope of securing big network computing systems without cryptography playing at least some part in that. So, you know, U.S. policy was essentially saying U.S. systems had to be insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I very naively, when I saw some of these crazy policies coming out, like key escrow and so on, figured that it was simply a matter of explaining this. Right, you know, that if we could just kind of go to
the rationality would hold the day.
Yeah, if we could just go to these policymakers and explain to them what the situation that everybody agreed on was, then that they would just say, oh, well, you know, thanks, Matt, for explaining it to us. You know, let us fix it. And that turns out, it turns out to be more complicated than that.
Right. So I have an analogy question for you. If the internet is in fact a series of tubes, what is cryptography?
If the internet is a series of tubes, what's cryptography? Wow. You know, that's a metaphor that I was utterly unprepared for.
Oh, well, if you're going to testify before Congress, well, I guess you're safe these days, actually.
Well, that's a great. I'm gonna get back to you, I guess.
You can post that as a blog entry for free.
Yeah, or maybe I'll make it an exam question next semester.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's a good way to get stuff done. Have graduate student slaves. So, like you, I have some fundamental concerns about individual liberty and privacy in the modern world, and I have a great deal of respect for your leadership in the area, by the way. So I thought it'd be fun to kind of go through a short list of topics and spend a couple of minutes on each idea. And I guess you've already kind of addressed key escrow, but I'd like you to dive into that a little bit more technically. I know you did some work on master key encryption, and you were involved not only in the public policy debate, but also on the technology side of that. Where do you, you know, what do you think about that these days? Is it something you're still thinking about, or has that just gone way by?
One of the problems with key escrow is that, you know, if you don't think about the technology at all, it sounds like it's just the perfect solution to, you know, to a difficult problem, right? We have the problem that crypto tries to keep, you know, bad people out, but we want to let good people in. And, you know, sometimes the good people are law enforcement. So if we can just come up with some magic technology that lets the good guys in, then all our problems are solved. But, you know, the problem is you need some magic technology to do it that we really don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the fundamental reasons that key escrow was so ill-timed from the government's point of view and so horrifying from the technologist's point of view is that if you go back to the time they first proposed this in the early 1990s, this was just at the point in history where two things were going on. The first is that the internet was just starting to become important.
Mm-hmm.
We were just starting to use this for things that really mattered to society as a whole to protect, you know, things like our financial infrastructure, and the term electronic commerce had just sort of been coined.
We'd gotten beyond Usenet news.
Right. We got beyond Usenet news, and we started to actually, you know, spend money on the internet. The term information economy, was bandied around, an information superhighway, and everybody understood that this was starting to become very important. And, of course, the question of securing this thing that's now suddenly very important, became really important. So suddenly we need to secure our computer infrastructure. And the second thing that's going on is that the hardware technology had just started to get to the point where it made sense to think about cryptography not as a physical box, but as software.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Crypto algorithms are a little bit slow. In the 1980s, 1970s, The rate that you could do encryption with a computer was probably slower than the rate that you could send data down the wire.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd almost always do the crypto algorithms in special purpose hardware.
And in the 70s, the wire didn't hold that many bits.
Wire didn't hold that many bits, but general purpose computers were slower and they were pretty well saturated doing the other things that they were doing.
Right.
So you really didn't want to spend cycles on your crypto algorithms, even though the wire was itself kind of slow. But you know, by the early 90s, the computer on your desktop, and you know, first of all, the whole concept that your computer would be on your desktop became kind of firmly established. And the computer on your desktop has extra cycles, and you know, all of a sudden, for the first time in the technology curve, we're able to think about doing crypto just using the spare cycles on the computer that you've got instead of buying a little box to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that for the first time, the marginal cost of crypto had the potential to be free. It was
mm-hmm.
just a matter of having software in your operating system or somewhere to do it for you. But what Key Escrow managed to do was take this thing that was about to become free and make it expensive again by requiring you to do it in hardware.
Right.
So, you know, forget about the other reasons to be really skeptical of the Key Escrow idea, like what happens if the keys end up in the wrong place. You know, from a privacy point of view, from an industry point of view, from an economic point of view, you know, what Key Escrow did from the very beginning was said, well, what this means is that if we have to do crypto with Key Escrow, you're not going to have very much crypto because, you know, no one's going to want to buy crypto hardware.
Which may well have been part of the point. Who knows?
Assuming that there was that much planning. But that goes back to that NSA versus civilian impedance mismatch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the NSA always thinks about crypto as being a hardware device because they need really high assurance crypto. You know, to this day, they do their crypto in hardware because the needs of the military community demand that. But for the rest of us, you know, software crypto is usually all right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Key Escrow idea that the NSA developed, you know, made these assumptions that were just wrong for the rest of us.
Right.
So, you know, you don't need to go to the kind of conspiracy theory, oh, they want our keys, they want to spy on all of us. You know, it just was a dumb idea from an economic and engineering economic point of view.
Incidentally, for those listeners who are interested, earlier episode of Silver Bullet, we talked to Dorothy Denning about the Clipper chip and all that stuff, which is another view of the same little bit of history, I suppose. It's a pretty good conversation. We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Sigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.sigital.com/realitycheck. The next thing I wanted to bring up was this notion of warrantless wiretapping,
mm-hmm.
which you've been talking about. And I know you wrote a very popular paper for IEEE S&P, and I can't remember the title of the paper, but we'll put a link to it on the website. Could you talk about that just a bit?
So, you know, in 2005, we discovered that the National Security Agency had approached AT&T and probably other telephone companies with a request to put infrastructure inside the domestic telephone network for the purpose of intercepting telephone and internet traffic that was traveling internationally as part of a wiretapping program that worked very differently from the way wiretaps traditionally have worked under U.S. law and in technological practice. You know, typically when the government wants to do a wiretap inside the United States, either as part of a criminal investigation, say to some mafioso or some drug dealer that they want to tap their telephone, they get a warrant naming the particular individual they're tapping, and the telephone lines that they're tapping go to the telephone company and get a feed of that person's telephone or internet traffic, whatever is in the warrant. And they get only the traffic that they that's associated with the person that they're going after. And even national security warrants in the United States work that way. If they're going after a suspected spy, they get a court order to get the telephone traffic of the person they suspect is a spy. And that's the way it's pretty well always worked. The Fourth Amendment seems to require that under U.S. law. And it has the built-in technical safeguard that the telephone company gives them pretty much only the traffic of the person that is named in the court order.
Mm-hmm.
What the government did after September 11th was very different from that. They went to the telephone companies and they said, we'd like to install a filter box in the central offices that you've got that handle international traffic. And we'd like to filter out ourselves the traffic that we want to tap. And don't worry, we'll only get traffic that we're authorized to get because it will be international instead of domestic. And, this first of all, from an architectural point of view, is completely different from the way wiretapping had been done in the past. Analogies aren't always very good, but this is really directly analogous to, instead of the telephone company delivering them the wires of their target, it's equivalent to the telephone company just kind of handing them the keys to the central office and saying, you guys find it yourself.
Only look at those wires.
Yeah, only look at those wires, and I'm sure you'll do a good job. Well, telephone networks are pretty complicated, so that's, technically a very difficult problem. And then the second question is, the choice of locations where they were doing this was very, very strange. Instead of, if they were interested, as they said, in the traffic entering and leaving the United States, one would assume that the natural place to do that would be at the transoceanic cableheads entering and leaving the country. But as we learned from Mark Klein, an AT&T technician who literally walked in, I believe, to the Electronic Frontier Foundation's office in San Francisco with a stack of documents describing the wiring diagrams of how this was being done.
Mm-hmm.
They did this not at the international cableheads, but in a central office inside the United States, in one case in the central office in downtown San Francisco, where some of the international traffic was routed, but also where purely domestic traffic is switched. And so instead of this interception at the place that's going to have only the traffic they are allowed to get and little or none of the traffic they're not allowed to get, they did it in a place that had both, probably in equal measures, the traffic they were after and the traffic they weren't supposed to be looking at. So from an architectural point of view, it was a really strange, very risky architecture.
That was very carefully put. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to impute any motives, because chances are the reason they did this was what was convenient. It was just easier to do it that way. I don't know why they chose to do this, and part of the reason we don't know why is the government hasn't said a word about what they did, what they were trying to do, and what safeguards were put in place.
Yeah, but these kind of over-collection issues, I guess, have always been something to be concerned with when you think about things like Echelon and Carnivore, which, had their own purposes that we understand, but yet you still have this design that just casts a very wide net.
Right, and this is an example of how, you know, architecture, the little details of the architecture really matter a lot. You know, we might be able to say that, all right, it might or might not be a legal policy, you know, consistent with the Fourth Amendment for the NSA to tap the international traffic going in and out of the U.S. But even if you acknowledge that the, or agree that the NSA should be allowed to do that, the way they actually went about doing it had its own problems. So, you know, we have to look at the implementation, and that really matters. And, you know, one of the things about working in computer security, particularly looking at surveillance technology, is the number of opportunities for those of us looking at the technological issues here to say, "I told you so," is just so large that you can't even count them anymore. So, you know, we warned of the possibility of overcollection, really the likelihood of overcollection, in our IEEE security and privacy article that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And, you know, earlier this year, the NSA came forward and said, oh, by the way, it turns out we had been overcollecting.
Right. So that brings to mind the next question I wanted to ask you. What responsibilities do technologists like you and me and Silver Bullet listeners have when it comes to safeguarding liberty and worrying about these things?
You know, I think the single most important thing is to stay engaged with the issue. You know, it's very easy to say, well, there are details about this that I don't know about. It's very complicated. I'm sure that the system will work in the long run. But, you know, in fact, the devil is very much in the details with these things. You know, the little details that we understand better than anybody are the difference between really harmless and terribly, terribly harmful. And, you know, in order to tell the difference, we have to keep asking the questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so stay interested, even when it gets muddied with enormous technical detail and when there are details missing. Just staying engaged and staying interested is really more important than anything.
Lots of good science is done by analogy, and you've made much of the relationship between physical locks and cryptography. What are some of the essential lessons to be drawn between locksmithing and lockpicking and modern computer security?
Well, I've always been interested in how we secure things in general. And, you know, I a few years ago, I started to look at mechanical locks from a cryptographic perspective. And one of the things that surprised me was that locks are very good, in fact, much, much better than almost any computing system in certain ways. You know, it's very rare to have terrible catastrophic failures in physical security systems. We know how to measure them reasonably well. You can buy a 10-minute rated safe or a half-hour rated safe, and it probably works against an adversary for at least 10 minutes or at least half an hour. We know how to measure security really well in that area. And, you know, when I first started studying this, one of the things that attracted me to it was the question of, well, how can we take some of the stuff that they seem to know far, far better than we do, and maybe steal some of those ideas to make computing systems better. But I also discovered that the opposite is true. There are other ways in which the analytical techniques of computer science and cryptography just can be dropped directly into physical security, and they tell you things that are very surprising. One of the things that I found was that master keyed lock systems are vulnerable to a type of attack that looks an awful lot like related key cryptanalysis. And if you think about locks in strictly mechanical terms, as you know, pieces of metal moving and friction and so on, that's not at all apparent. But as soon as you abstract them out in the way a computer scientist or a cryptographer would, the vulnerabilities become very, very obvious very quickly. So one of the things that I think that taught me was that thinking about things abstractly has real value. You know, it's not just something we annoy students with. You know, knowing how to think about things in abstract terms and trying to separate the implementation from what that implementation is doing can often tell you some very surprising things.
Mm-hmm. I bet your students like working on that stuff too, huh?
I think it annoys them more than anything else because my students who want to sit there and write code, I make them learn how to pick locks
and think by analogy. So I read on your blog about your visit to David Byrne's building, I guess, last July.
The playing the building exhibit.
Yeah, which was set up to be played, exactly. And I wondered whether you've listened to the new Eno Byrne album and whether you like that.
It's on my iPod, and it keeps me company on my many long flights.
Do you like that better than, say, normal old Eno or normal old Byrne?
You know, I have to admit that, I think one of the things I'm least qualified as is as a music critic. So I would be really hesitant to have anybody follow my musical recommendation. But you know, I'm a child of the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, so I like the older stuff.
It's a good blend.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The May-June issue of IEEE S&P is a special issue on securing online games, edited by me and Ming Chow. The issue includes articles about cheating, virtual economies, the law, and security mechanisms. Show links, notes, and an online discussion around Silver Bullet can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.